So, okay. So yesterday we introduced the problems in the Gemara. Let's quickly recap. So again, we'll present it as it is presented in the Gemara in Menachot. Gemara in Menachot introduced a halacha that the last eight took from the Torah, Yachid Kareotam, whatever that means. Some of you have started to look at the Rishonim on that. Some of you have not. Okay. The Gemara at first suggests that that is dependent on the authorship question, right? Meaning, if you think that the last eight psukim in the Torah were not written by Moshe but by Yehoshua, and we're going to get, this should be obvious that the Gemara actually adduces a pasuk in Makot for this, of why if it wasn't Moshe it was Yehoshua. I thought that'd be obvious, but the Gemara actually has a pasuk for that, but we'll come back to that. But the Gemara's first attempt is to say that if the last eight psukim are treated differently, then that must mean that Moshe did not write them, Yehoshua wrote them. If you think that Moshe wrote them, then they are equivalent to everything else, and therefore whatever Yachid Kareota means will not apply to those eight psukim. Okay? Good. Then the Gemara, in order to explain this, had to introduce that authorship machloket, right? Which is, again, it's an independent unit, which the Gemara introduces in Targum Mara, where it introduces Rabbi Yehuda or Rabbi Nechemya versus Rabbi Shimon. Are the eight psukim at the end of the Torah written by Moshe or not? Now, the reason to say they are not is because Moshe is dead. Right? Very simple. This is not a lot of chachma. To the argument, at least as it seems in the Gemara, as to why one would want to claim that Moshe did write them despite the technical problem that he is dead, is because... Why? Right? Because... Right, because the Torah indicates that Moshe gave the Torah, and the Torah is normally understood to mean the whole thing, and therefore for Moshe to give the Torah, referred to as the Torah, and it for to be missing a psukim is problematic, right? That was... Now, the Gemara then moves to the question of, okay, well, if Moshe did write it, then how did he write it? Right, because we have not yet solved the problem that he is dead, right? So the Gemara introduces this ambiguous phrase, which is Moshe katav bidema. Moshe writes bidema, but it's actually part of a longer phrase, which is right until this point in the Torah, Hashem dictates and Moshe writes. Hashem dictates, Moshe repeats and then writes, and here Hashem dictates and Moshe writes bidema, right? And that is apparently supposed to solve our problem, right? At least according to that position. Right, that's where we were. So let's start today with the question of, okay, what is bidema, and how exactly does it solve our problem? Right, again, our problem is, what is our problem? Our problem is that Moshe is, I mean, the problem in the Gemara, two questions. One is, again, there's two things we have to do today. One is, what does bidema mean? What does this mean? And two is, how does it solve the problems that it's trying to solve, right? Don't get lost, right? You always have to remember that we have to figure out what bidema means, but the reason we're figuring out what bidema means is because that's supposed to be the magic solution to Moshe somehow writing psukim about his own death in past tense. Okay?
You can write stuff about yourself in past tense anyway.
Yes, but it is a lie, right? If you write, I have already done something, which you're doing tomorrow, it is a lie.
Okay, you wrote about his future in past tense.
Yes, that would be a lie, potentially, right? Assuming that might be, that is the simplest understanding of what the problem is here.
I'm finishing Rav Zering Shir at the same time.
I have finished, yes.
I have finished.
But you have not.
My notes, they'll realize I have finished when I finished those, at the end of those notes.
Ah, yes, but what happens if in the middle of shear you get pulled out for an emergency and do not finish the shear? Like the electricity goes again. And Yosef, therefore, is not in shear. Right, so you can always solve that with Nevuah, right? It will happen. Okay, it doesn't change the falsehood of the statement. It just changes the accuracy, right? It will definitely eventually be true, but it is not yet. But okay. What does bidema mean? So let's try to tackle this. What does the word bidema mean? So let's take this at different levels. Okay? We mentioned this a little bit yesterday, but let's start this again. Okay. Just, we'll do this in levels. Word, and then phrase. Right? First we've got to figure out what the word means, and then we got to figure out what that actually means in context, right? Okay. So what does the word bidema mean? So one possibility is tears. What else might it mean? So it might mean with tears, might mean in tears, right? Both of those would mean that dema means, right, tears, or crying, or something like that. What else might it mean? That would be the same, right? Meaning the shoresh here would be dalad mem ayin, right? Would be like from dema'ot, right? Well, so what would the shoresh be? Right, meaning, not theoretically, like what might this word mean, right? Dema, right, I know what the shoresh is. Dalad mem ayin can mean, right, crying, tears, right? No, that the shoresh there would be? First of all, that's a hey, not an ayin, right? And what else might it mean? I mentioned this yesterday. What? So those are both mean that, okay, so both of those. So now we have one interpretation of the word dema and two interpretations of the phrase. Okay? Speak it, right? Both, we have one possibility is that dema means tears. Now either we can understand it meaning he wrote it while crying, or with tears, like physically, as a the chomer of what he is writing with. But what else might it mean? Did anyone get to the gra yet or not yet? The gra. I'll take it as a nod. But okay, so I'll say it outside for now, right? The other possibility is that the word means, another shoresh, it can mean mixed up, right? In halakha, if you have truma, which gets mixed up in chulin, right? So truma can only be eaten by kohanim, right? And therefore, what happens is you get mixed up in chulin, right? So now you can't eat the whole mixture, and that mixture in halakha is called miduma. Miduma. Okay? Same shoresh, dalad mem ayin. So the other possibility is that the word, the shoresh, not the phrase yet, but the word means mixed up, right? Bidema means bidimua, right? Mixed up. Okay? That, now what, how will this solve any of our problems? Okay? So let's try to figure this out. So, okay. So, name me a mifaresh who thinks the word dema means tears. You can start with the easiest of them, yeah? No, really, the easiest. What's the easiest? He's on the page. The one you should all see first. Thank you. Rashi, yay! Right, we all love Rashi. We start with Rashi. We always start with Rashi. Right, Rashi says that dema means tears. Now, does he translate it as with tears or while crying?
While crying,
good, right? Prove that to me. What does he say? Dove, prove it to me. Wait, what does Rashi say?
I didn't say it afterwards.
Right, Loyama.
Because he was in affliction.
And yeah, he was in pain. Right, he was in pain. Right? Meaning Rashi thinks that bidema doesn't mean he was writing with tears, it means he was writing while crying. Right? Now, that explains just the word. Okay? Now we got two more things, or the word and the phrase really, okay, for Rashi. Everything has to be methodical here. How does that solve the problem? And how does that explain, right? How does that solve the problem? Let's start with that. Right.
If it says the first portion of what he wrote was dictation, repeat, and then write. Now it's just dictation. He's now crying.
Good. So the first thing you have to note is that for Rashi, the issue is not really the fact that he's crying at all. Okay. Did everyone catch that point in Rashi? Right, that for Rashi, the fact that he is crying does not solve anything halakhically. Right? Yes, the phrase means he is crying, but that doesn't solve the problem. Right? Again, the problem is what? What was the problem we're trying to solve? How could Moshe write his own death? Right? Saying he's crying while he's writing his own death helps
nothing.
Right? For Rashi, the key is that the crying prevented him from doing what? From verbalizing, right, from saying that which God said. And for Rashi, the significant change right, is not the fact that he's crying, but the result of that crying. Now, someone who builds this up, you look for just for a second in these sources I gave you, on page, and I won't torture you to read all this because he's very hard to read, on page 6, the Abarbanel, right, we're jumping a few hundred years. Oh, I did this last year, but I forgot. We're starting a new year, so I have to do this again. When did Rashi live? What's his name? Let's make sure we get this.
Where were you talking?
Living? Where does he live?
He lived in France.
France in Switzerland.
One century. 11th century, thank you. The 11th century, right? First he learns in the Batei Medrash of... Right, the Rhineland, but he lives primarily in France. Okay? Good. Now we're going to skip for a moment to the Abarbanel. When does the Abarbanel live? What is the Abarbanel's full name, first of all? Yitzchak. Yitzchak Dan Abarbanel. Right? He lives where?
In Spain.
Eventually. He starts in?
Portugal.
Oh my God. Starts in Portugal. Right? He starts in Portugal, is chased out of Portugal personally because of wealth and greed and, you know, things like that. Then he moves to Spain. That doesn't work out so well for him because, you know, he moves there in the 1480s. It's not a great time to move to Spain as a Jew. And then he moves from there to Italy. Right? He moved to Venice. Okay. So the Abarbanel writes a lot, always. If you ever want to feel inferior about yourself, you just read in Abarbanel. Who is the leading world scholar in Abarbanel? Who was? He's not alive anymore. Who was the leading scholar of Abarbanel? His last name is more famous than his first name. Hint, his last name is the same name as his son, who is the longest running prime minister of the state of Israel.
Netanyahu.
Yes, Netanyahu.
Oh,
yes, Netanyahu is the longest. Yes, hit July and Netanyahu became the longest running prime minister of the state of Israel. His father, Benzion Netanyahu, was the leading scholar in Abarbanel. So you read his book on Abarbanel, you'll discover that Abarbanel, you were right. It was right. Yeah, you're two for two today.
Okay.
So Netanyahu wrote a book on Abarbanel, and he notes that the Abarbanel is not like some people, you know, like write all the time, and therefore they end up with big books, right? The Abarbanel, like if you want an idea of how much he writes, this is most of what he wrote on one pasuk, right? Right, this page thing here, right? He does this on everything. He wrote most of his book in a matter of weeks. Like he would have spurts of writing. So like Yehoshua, his parish in Yehoshua, he wrote in like 2 weeks. And his parish in Shoftim wrote in like 2 weeks, and Shmuel in a month. Right? Like he had like a good summer, so he put out 3 books, and then he didn't write for 10 years because, you know, he got kicked out of 3 countries in that time, right? And then he had a spurt and he wrote another book. So the Abarbanel is writing about this sugya. And if you look all the way at the left column here in 6, on page 6, got it? Where they underlined it nicely for you? He just says, Ubipnei habichia lohaya yachol lachzor ha'amira. Right? I mean, he's clarifying, what does Rashi mean? Because he was crying, he could not repeat, write the words. Avalaya kotvam kasher sham'am. He would just say what, he would write what he heard. V'zeo sh'amar Reb Shimon, ad kan HaKadosh Baruch Hu omer Moshe omer v'kotev. Mikan v'alecha HaKadosh Baruch Hu omer Moshe kotev b'dema. Klomar, Shalaya omer. Right? I mean, the key isn't that he was crying. The key is that he didn't say, Otam b'nei b'chiyato. Right? He didn't say those words because he was crying. V'dimato alechayo. Right? His tears are on his cheeks. Right, and just to make it clear that he thinks the word, right, that this is, that bidema doesn't mean the substance he was writing, is he said Moshe wrote it in ink, right? The substance of his writing is ink. The context is silent tears. Okay, you can get that image in your head, right? Moshe crying, writing his own death, unable to verbalize Vayamat Sham Moshe. Okay, you can imagine this. I hope your imaginations are all capable of imagining the emotions of someone who is told by God, please, I need you to do me a favor, please write your death right now. Right? And that person might be choking up. Yes? Good? Okay. Now, that is simply the word and phrase bedema. Now explain to me the halacha. Why does that matter? Right? Remember, again, you always have to keep this in mind. What are we trying to solve? Right? One position says that the last eight psukim in the Torah written by Yoshua. The other shita says it's not true. It was written by Moshe because the Torah needs to be complete. And somehow all the problems that generated the position that it was written by Yeshua are supposed to be solved by this scene. So how does this scene solve anything? Yeah, Darius.
Well, it solves the question of how they put the completed
Well, that was his question. Well, that was his question against the person who wrote, right? The Shita who holds that Moshe wrote the whole Torah, his problem was that he didn't believe the Torah could be incomplete. Right? You're right. It solves that problem. But what about the other problem, which is how could Moshe write his own death? Right? Good, so there's the question of how did he know? Answer, Nevuah. What about the lying problem? Good, fine, you'll say it. Ah. So this is what the Marsha says, right? And this opens a can of worms, the possibility that writing a lie is not as bad as saying a lie, right? Which is hard to buy, right? Right, I don't know if anyone else finds it hard to buy. I find it hard to buy that writing a lie is not so bad. Right?
It's worse.
It's like contracts. It's
fine. Yes, yes. Just forge contracts and it's fine. Just don't say it out loud. Right?
Right. The agreements, things that everyone just agree for, there's clearly some stuff in there that's that are a lot.
No, and they're legally binding, and just know that the fact that you haven't read them is not a defense in court. I can show you this in many countries. So no, they cannot be lies. They are legally binding documents, and if there was a lie, then you could actually sue. But no, now you could just say, well, he's not worried about the lie. He's not worried about the lie, right? Meaning, it's not really a lie. Everyone understands. So he's just, it's practical. What is he supposed to do, right? Wait till he's dead to write his own death, right? He can't do it. Fine, it's not a lie, right? But there's one more problem that you're going to have to solve, and that is, the end of the Gemara argues that what? Remember, at the beginning of the Gemara argued that there only is a halachic difference in the last day. Psukim is written by Yeshua. The Gemara's answer is
it's different. Also.
It's always different. So now you have one more question that you need to answer is why does the fact that Moshe didn't verbalize the Torah, why does that matter? Right? Why does that matter such that that would be considered transformative enough? Right, that now the last eight psukim in the Torah would have a different halacha. Right? I understand they're written by a different author. That's a pretty big change. But why would the fact that Moshe wrote them in permanent ink, but he simply at God's dictation, but simply didn't verbalize it before he wrote it? Why would that make any difference? Go. Yes, I'm asking you. Go.
Because if he's right, even though he's still technically writing a lie. He did it in somewhat of a distress, and the fact that God gave him the law. So what differentiates it is that Moshe doesn't necessarily want to write it, and he knows that it is a lie, but it is still something that he had to write down. So it basically sets it in a different category.
Okay, so one interesting possibility. Now I haven't seen anyone say it, but I think there's actually a good logic to it, and this may actually be what the Abarbanel wants, right? Is to say, right? No, that actually changes it enough, right? It doesn't matter. They didn't say it in It doesn't matter that he didn't say it with, that he wrote it the same way. The very fact that he's in a different emotional, psychological state that prevents him from doing what he's normally doing actually changes it. Why would that be true? Well, I think you'd have to add one assumption here, which is that Nevuah, in general, is not the word of God. Okay? Now, someone's going to take that sound bite and say, I'm a heretic. What is Nevuah, right? Nevuah is...
God communicates.
Good, right? It's God communicates, and then that message is refracted through the Navi, right? Hence, different Nevi'im, right? They take God's word and it presents itself in their own words, right? Chazal talk about this already, that that you look at different Nevi'im, some are written in highfalutin Hebrew and some are written in not highfalutin Hebrew, right? Depending on whether the Navi was, yeah, highfalutin, right? Right? You're safe. Anyways, right? And you can see this, right? Certain Nevi'im are, their character comes across, right? Like, I don't think, you know, God is particularly angrier at any given moment, right? If he's, but all the Nevi'im that are talking about the Churban, right, and are telling the Jews that they're sinning, and God is equally, so to speak, conveying his anger, right? Certain Nevi'im just seem to be angrier people, like Hosea. Good example is Amos. Like Amos. Amos is an angry person, right? He just is. Okay, you read Amos, he's angry. You're like, how do I know he's angry? Because he says he's angry. He comes and he says, why am I here? You people are annoying me. I'm not a Navi by trade. My father wasn't a Navi. I'm a cowboy. And I'm here. And I don't want to be here. Right? And you are all fat cows. Right? That is what he says. Right? That is a quote, by the way. That's not like a paraphrase. Right? That is what he says. Right? Now, who is the exception to this? Who is the only Navi that is not true about? Thank you, Moshe. Right? How do I know?
Moshe, whenever he got Nevuah, all the Navis weren't able to just regularly stand there. They were called like a...
Correct. He was awake, right?
He was awake and
how do I know this? How do you know this?
Because he responds to Hashem.
This is not a trick question, by the way.
Because it says so?
Yeah, because it says so. Where does it say so? In what book?
Does it not say so in the Torah? Or?
Yes, it says so in the Torah. This was not a trick question. This is not a trick question. Panim el panim. In fact, it's in these psukim. He spoke panim and panim. Lokam navi od kim Moshe. He's the, right? Bechol beitin emanhu is what Hashem says to Miriam. Right? Miriam and Aharon. Moshe is unique. His nevuah is face to face. Or as Chazal put it in their mashal, Kol Navi mitnabe ba'asbaklariya she'enam ira. Moshe mitnabe ba'asbaklariya ira. Right? All other prophets prophesize through a not clear asbaklariya, which is simple English lens. In fancy English, it is translated as a speculum. But as Elliot Wolfson translates the phrase, Moshe prophesied through the speculum that shines. Which just means a clear lens, a non-blurry lens. But yes, his nevuah is in some sense more direct from God, right? It is possible, however, to understand it the way Dov wants to say it, which is maybe what's going on here is that this nevuah is in some way less clear because Moshe is distressed, right? Moshe is in a, right, what allows, right, the Rambam makes this clear, right, what allows Nevi'im to have better Nevuah is if they are in control of their emotion, control of their intellect, right, control of their midot. But if someone is now shaken and is in an existentially different state, to the extent that Nevuah is refracted through the lens of the Navi, if the Navi's state of being is now different, right, emotional state, psychological state, it could be, right, one could make the argument, like Dov is making, that essentially that Nevuah is qualitatively different. How does that express itself? I'm not sure, right, besides this halacha, yachid kareotam, right, but that would be an argument. Okay, yeah.
So, would the argument also be, I mean, the
first of good. So now you're going to tell me Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim attempts a different approach. He takes a more formal approach. Good. What does he say?
Reb Chaim.
Did anyone who? Where did you go? Who? By the way, who read Reb Chaim? Just not everyone has read Reb Chaim yet.
Yeah, we did, but like...
Okay, this is not like a...
Yeah.
I just want to know so that I know it going in. Yeah.
I think it was kind of like this. It was saying that Nevi'im... started off talking about the difference between Nevi'im and Kesubim. That Kesubim was... When the stuff was written down, it was just written, but it wasn't spoken aloud as it was written. As opposed to Nevi'im and, I guess, the Torah, which were spoken aloud as they were written. But these last eight psukim weren't spoken aloud.
Perfect.
So they have the same quality as the Kesubim.
Very good. So Reb Chaim presents a very... Right, so let's flesh out what Reb Chaim says.
How that fits in with the Nevuah itself.
Okay, good. Good. So let's take it from... Right. Exactly. So now let's take Reb Chaim and try it out. Right? Reb Chaim goes in this direction and essentially is a defense of Rashi. Right? He's trying to argue what might it mean that he was writing with tears and therefore it changed it. Okay. To get to that, he has a different question, right? Which is, what is the difference between Nevi'im and Ksuvim? Right? Now, before you start Reb Chaim, right, if I asked you what is the difference between Nevi'im and Ksuvim, what would you say? You're like, it's not as a, that Reb Chaim is not necessarily the only answer, but what might you say? What is the difference between Nevi'im and Ksuvim? Why are they canonized differently? So you might say they're later on. Is that true? No. Right? Right? How do I know it's not true? You might think it's true, but it's not true. How do I know it's not true?
Tehillim was written by David.
Yeah, because many of the books are contemporaneous. Right? Rut is contemporaneous with Shoftim. Right? Tehillim is contemporaneous with David. Right? Shir Shirim, Kohelet, Mishle are Shlomo. Hence, right? It's not about time. Okay, good. That should also... that should prevent you from saying what many people say, which is obviously incorrect, which is Nevi'im is written by prophets and Ksuvim is written not by prophets. That's wrong. How do I know that's wrong? Correct. And it was written by the same people, right? There are a lot of people who have a book in each, right? Shmuel wrote Shoftim, Shmuel, and Rut, right? Hence, it cannot be, right? David, Navi.
Can we say that, well,
So Reb Chaim introduces a different formulation. Now it comes in different ways. Now you should know that the Chiddush Reb Chaim ala Shas are not written by him, right? These are students' notes, so there are different versions of in different places, right? He suggests that the fundamental difference between them is the following. Okay? Nevi'im are prophecies that were meant to be said to the people. Ksuvim were things that were meant to be written, right? I'll try that again, right? Meaning, Yoshua is primarily the record of things that were actually said to the Jews at the time and were then recorded for posterity. But the initial Nivuot were intended as communication for the Jews living then. They, albeit they have meaning for the future, right? But they are, but their original intent was like Nivuah for that time. As opposed to, let's say, Tehillim. Now, Darius is right. He doesn't mean that Tehillim is not written. Like, it's not that David didn't say them. It's that they weren't public communication. Right? David wrote it. Like, David sat in his room, right? And David, you know, he was a musician. He sang his song. He wrote the lyrics. He put it down. He wrote it as a holy song. Right? But it didn't start as a communication between the Navi and people. It was divinely inspired writing, right, rather than communication that was then written down. Okay? That's essentially Reb Chaim's argument. Okay? Now, Reb Chaim argues that Nevi'im, the books of Nevi'im, are primarily, therefore, this collection of things that started as orations, right, and then were written down. Ksuvim begin as things that are meant to be conveyed as written material. The Torah, he argues, is both. Right? Is both. Right? He argues that the Torah was both. Moshe was supposed to communicate it directly to the Jewish people, and he was supposed to record the Nevuah. Meaning, the Torah isn't, right? There is no primacy to one or the other, right? Moshe was constantly teaching the Jewish people the laws as conveyed from God, and he was also meant to create this text called the Torah, right? It wasn't just like, oh, after the fact, this is something that the posterity should know, right? It was that the Torah itself has both levels. It is a communicative text, sorry, it is a record of a communication and a text that was meant as a text, right? Hence, Right? If you think about it, this is why, right? In the Torah, in addition to the fact that we recognize that the Jews were communicating with Moshe, right, that's where we believe that every letter and every, you know, every letter, every turn of phrase has meaning, because it was also written as a text, right? You don't do the same in Nevi'im, right? In Nevi'im, we don't have these drashot on, extra vavs, right? Because it's not written in that way, right? Now, Tshuvim, we don't do it either, but it's not. It's also not written in that way, even though it is written as a canonical text in that sense, right? So Reb Chaim argues that the Torah has sort of both levels. It was both meant primarily to be an oration, right, a communication, and it was meant to be a canonical text at the same time. And every time Moshe would get a communication from God, he would present it as a nevuah and create a ksuvim, so to speak. Right? That's the uniqueness of Torah. Now, based on that, Reb Chaim takes a formal approach to Rashi. Right? Not, yeah, he was sad, and therefore it shook him, and therefore this was a different experience. Right? What does he say? He says, once you recognize that there are two levels to Torah, right? Nevi'im has one level, Ksuvim is the other level, and Torah has, right, the synthesis of the two. If you were to remove one level, what would happen to it? It would become more, yeah, meaning it would, just like Nevi'im and Ksuvim are holy, but not as holy as Torah, the Torah itself, if you removed one of those elements, would be lesser Torah. And therefore he argues that if Moshe was incapable of verbalizing the Torah, he wrote this without verbalizing, without communicating to the Jewish people in his room crying, then this, while these eight psukim may be part of Torah, what are they? Essentially, ksuvim. Right? They're ksuvim without the added element of nevuah, which without that double level will not make it Torah.
So what do we say the Nevi'im about how the nevuah? Like, why do we have Nevi'im texts?
So why do we have Nevi'im text? So the Gemara has a rule for it. The Gemara's rule is that any Navi that is written, right, any Nevuah that is written, it's because that it was determined that they have lessons for all times. Right? Meaning,
at what point was that determined? At the time they were given?
Or in the subsequent years, yeah. Right? Meaning not necessarily simultaneously, right? But in the subsequent years, meaning we know that there were many, many more Nevi'im than we have as books. Right? Right? Anyone who's ever read Navi knows that, for example, how many prophecies do you know that Shaul had? How many? Thank you. None. But was he a prophet?
Yes.
How do you know that? Because it says so. That's often going to be the answer to the question. So don't be afraid to just say, it says so. Right? Meaning, at some point, Shaul goes amongst the Nevi'im, right, starts to prophesy, and the people say, Hagam Shaul Benevi'im, right? I mean, it's just that's what they say, right? He prophesies it. Elisha, right? Elisha is a Navi, we know he has prophecies. How many students does he have? A lot. They build a city of just prophets, and it is so crowded, they have to leave the city and move to the Jordan River Valley to set up a, like, monastery, right?
So what makes a prophet?
They talk to God. How many of their prophecies do we know? Zero, right? Because Elisha had nevuot that are relevant for us, apparently, and all his students, I don't know what they did, but they didn't have prophecies that we're supposed to know. Eliyahu had many, many, many students. How many of his students do we know their prophecies?
Zero.
No.
Oh, come on.
Trick question. One. And his name was? Elisha. It was a trick question, but only because I had given you the answer before. Elisha is the one student of Eliyahu whose message we know, right? So the answer is nevuah, right? Nevuah just meant you talk to God, right? Maybe you had a message for other people. The Sifrei Nevuah, those which got canonized into the Tanakh, as Chazal understand it, are those that have messages forever, right? If they were just prophecies for that time that were temporal in nature, then they were, in that time they were said, and that was it.
Okay,
right?
But the difference being, or the Nevuah written at the time of the messages, the original
presentation.
Or yeah. Was as writing, whereas Nevi'im was all.
Correct. And the Torah is both, right? I mean, the Torah was simultaneous. Moshe would write it down and teach it. Write it down and teach it. And therefore, Reb Chaim, now coming back to Rashi, says, right, remember, this whole analysis was to get back to Rashi, which was... Well, we in fact know that to be true, because the Torah says that, right? Meaning that everything... That's exactly how the Torah works, right? Well, that right, that's what we find out when that's what we find out in which parsha? Okay, which parsha do we get a summary of it in? Because you have no excuse to not know this one. Now, this week's parsha. It is this week's parsha. It is in Shoftim, right, where Moshe says, right, at Har Sinai, which was the first time we heard it in Yitro, God was speaking. You couldn't handle it, so you said, "Please speak to God on our behalf." And God said, "Sure. From now on, I will say everything to you, and Moshe will say it to the Jewish people." Right? Meaning, this is a pasuk. This is not like this is not guesswork. Right? So Moshe. So the whole Torah, yeah, the whole Torah until this point, Moshe would receive it and would communicate it. Right? Now Chazal had this whole method that they think it would happen, that Moshe would teach it to the right to this Zkenim, and he would teach it to Elazar, and he would teach it to Aaron.
So we assume that Moshe was that gracious first Zkenim
for the world after that point? Like until Matan Torah is a bit right tricky, and that's why the Gemara has a machloket about it. Right? Meaning until that point everything is given in one shot. Right? Meaning until Matan Torah everything's given in one shot. Right, that's a bit different, right? Whether Moshe then says it over when he gets it, I guess he did, right? But yes, I think that obviously is given in one shot. After that, it's not clear, right? Whether it's given parsha nitna or stuma nitna, which is a machlokan in the Gemara, right? Meaning it's one big unit till the end, or not. But yeah, presumably that first half of the Torah, or the first third of the Torah, whatever it is given in one unit, and Moshe conveys it as such, and it's a little bit different in that sense. Now remember, just because it happened at a different time doesn't violate this theory. Right? This theory isn't that things have to be written as they happen, it's that the nevuah has to be written. Right? The nevuah has to be written and communicated as it is given. Right? Meaning, just because it happened in the past, right, if God gave it as a prophecy and Matan Torah and Moshe conveyed it and wrote it down, that would still fit the bill for Reb Chaim. So Reb Chaim's argument, therefore... So now let's go through every stage. You notice we've gone through different things. How does he understand the word bidema? With crying, right? How does he understand the right? So what is the halachic? Right. The real issue here isn't the crying; it's the lack of verbalization. And why does that have halachic implications for Reb Chaim?
Because then it has the status of ketuvim.
Because it has the status of ketuvim and not Torah, because it lacks the level of nevuah, meaning. Nevuah meant for oration. Right, so far what we've seen is two possibilities. Right? Both of them understanding the Dema as tears, both of them understand that the primary issue was not the tears but the fact that it wasn't repeated. One focusing on perhaps since Moshe's state of being was different, the Nevuah therefore is somehow different, right? Because Nevuah is refracted through the Navi. Or as Reb Chaim in a much more formal sense, right, because Moshe was unable to verbalize it. Because Moshe was unable to verbalize the words God was saying, it has the status of ksuvim and not Torah, meaning which is nevuah plus ksuvim. Now, by the way, how does this solve the lying problem? Does it solve the lying problem?
No.
I'm not sure it doesn't, actually. Right, think about it. It might actually solve the lying problem. Why? Because according to Reb Chaim, what's the difference between Nevuah and Ksuvim? Right, meaning Nevuah are things that are meant to be said at that time. Ksuvim are things that are meant for posterity. Right? Things that are meant to be communicated later. Things that are meant to be communicated in real time should, right, talk about now and not the future. But things that are meant to be future-esque, right, meaning they're being recorded for posterity only, right? You know, it's the equivalent of someone who writes an ethical will. Right? You know what an ethical will is? Or a will, right? After someone dies, If you're reading this, I am dead. Right? My children, right? An ethical, right? You put in a letter. If you're reading this, I am dead. And this is what I want to tell you. Right? It's not a lie. Right? Someone wrote it. If you're reading this, I am dead. I'm not yet dead, but I'm now sealing it in an envelope. And when you open it, if you open it, that means I am dead. Right? Right? And this is what I must tell you, my child. Right? An ethical will is when someone passes on. It can be given during the life, while someone's alive. It's not giving over money, it's giving over messages. Right? But sometimes people will leave that in a letter to be read posthumously. Okay. Now, there is another halachic implication which actually highlights Reb Chaim's understanding. This is what Tosfos writes. Tosfos writes in who? Anyone read? Get to Tosfos Umoshe, the one I told you, the third Tosfos. Okay. Okay, good. So let's look at that quickly. We have a few more minutes on this. Okay, Moshe Kotev, the third Tosfos on the Daf and Menachot. Umoshe Kotev, Yesh Tvarim deGarsi Umoshe Omer veKotev. Right, he said some versions have the Girsa actually, which would obviously throw everything we said into chaos, that Moshe verbalized and said. And this is a chumrah that when a sofer is writing the Torah, he should not only write the text, right, but he should verbalize it. And he notes that this Girsa doesn't work for Rashi, because Rashi, he then quotes Rashi, who says that the difference between the rest of the Torah and these Ipsukim are that Moshe did not verbalize it. But in general, you do. Now, if you look at this sheet that I gave you, right, the original sheet I gave you, right, the Torah Chaim, right, what does the Torah Chaim quote from the Torah? Right? He says, well, he quotes this halacha from Tosfot, right, that normally a sofer should always verbalize before he writes. Except, what would be the exception to that? Right, what would the possible exception to that be? The Epsukim. Right, you could potentially make the argument that, look, right, if the job of a sofer is to do what? Is to basically mimic Moshe, and therefore there's this chumrah that you should write and verbalize it when you write, right? If you follow Rashi, then it might end up being that what? For the last Epsukim, right, you wouldn't do that. Right? That you wouldn't do that. What? Sorry, I just put the Torah Chaim because it was easier. He just quotes this halacha from Tosfos from the Torah, right? That normally you're supposed to write and verbalize when you write the Torah, right? This chumrah. Where are you now? Is it because of bitur? That you shouldn't even let someone else dictate unless you're going to verbalize. Right, I mean, that is, right, he just quotes the Torah.
Wait, but is he talking about the last?
No, he's talking about in general, like Tosfot. Right? Like the rest of the Torah, at least. Right? Now, he doesn't spell out the last Ipsokim, but I think one could suggest, right, that a possible expression of Reb Chaim would be, right? You could argue that maybe, even if this halacha were true, maybe, right, for the last 8 sukkah in the Torah, one would not have to, right?
But absolutely, that, say that you shouldn't be reading it at somebody else's dictation, doesn't make sense, because maybe you can, you just have to say it yourself.
No, that's what he says. Right, unless Ella Imkain Yachzor Huvikra Befiv, unless you read it yourself.
Oh.
Right, I mean, he's just quoting Tosos, he's quoting the Torah.
But you can make another chumrah and say, oh, maybe your Rebbe should be reading it, right? Or maybe somebody else.
Correct, you could always.
You're being dictated to dress like Moshe.
Correct. You could add all types of suggestions. It happens to be that we don't take it that seriously, right? It's a chumrah. But I wonder, right, whether anyone would say, but maybe for the last 8 psukim, according to Rashi, you wouldn't. Right, that's what I wonder here. Okay. Now, that was all possibility one, that dema means tears, but it doesn't mean that that's the substance of the writing. It means crying. Now, possibility two is that bedema means tears, and it doesn't mean while he was crying, it means? Who holds that? Yeah, the Ritva, thank you. I'm not trying to trick you, it's just the next one, right? How do I know that's what the Ritva says? Because he says, Peirush, v'hefresh she'beineihem, right? First he quotes, Yesh gorsin HaKadosh Baruch Hu Omer Moshe Kodei Mikan Melech HaKadosh Baruch Hu Omer Moshe Kodei Bedema. Peirush, v'hefresh she'beineihem, what's the difference? Ki ha'reishonim nichtavim bidyo, v'acharonim nichtavim bedema. Right? This is what the Abar Manel said was not true. Right? Meaning, Dema replaces, it's not explaining context, it's replacing Dio, right? The emphasis here isn't that Moshe, that God is talking or not talking, Moshe is talking, not talking. The difference is, what are you writing with, right? Dema or Dio, right? Ink or tears. And then his second possibility is, right, his second possibility is what? What we already said. Right? Possibility two in the Ritva is what we just said. Is that no, he's just crying, and therefore he doesn't get a chance to repeat, because normally you would repeat what God said, and here he wouldn't, etc. That's the second possibility. But his first possibility, right, is different. Is that the word dema means tears, but it doesn't mean in tears, like crying. It means with tears instead of ink. Right? Now, let's quickly go through the steps again. Word means tears. The phrase means tears as ink. Right? Now, how does this now solve the lawing problem, and then how does this solve the halachic problem?
The lying problem, because it's like invisible.
Yeah, good. It solves the lying problem, kind of rad, because it's invisible ink. Right? How does it solve the halachic problem? Right? It's an attempt to have your cake and eat it too, which is... How, right, remember, this is according to the Shita who says that Moshe gave the entire Torah. So how would he give the entire Torah? Correct. He wrote it in disappearing ink. Because think about it, right? He wrote it with his tears. The first second you can see it, then it dries up and you can only see the remnant, right? Which means for a moment Moshe wrote the entire Torah, but it wasn't a lie because it disappeared. And Yoshua just filled it in. Why does it have a different halachic status? Because it was written by Yoshua. In the end of the day, the permanent version was written by Yoshua. Right? Moshe only wrote the invisible ink, right? Disappearing ink version of Torah. Okay. Let's see what we have. 7 minutes. Okay, let's try to get finished dema for today. Possibility three, as I mentioned, is... Right? Dema means, right, mixed up. Right? Comes from bidimua. For now, so very quickly, this is normally quoted from the Gra. I gave it to you here. If you look on page 5. So I'm going to... Should I say this outside for you? I'll say this one outside, okay? Because there's a bit of Kabbalah going on, so let me explain where he gets from, okay? Here's his claim. And you can read this inside tomorrow and maybe we'll come back to it, but let me get the claim out there. Well, yes, exactly. Right, he argues that according to the Ramban, and this is a traditional Kabbalistic theory, the Torah represents God's names. Right? It is the encapsulation of God's name, whatever that means. Shmotav Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Based on this, he writes that Moshe wrote down all the letters, right? Right, he wrote down all the letters. But he wrote them in a way that nobody understood them. He wrote them in a way that they expressed the deep inner Kabbalistic truths of the Torah, right? The names of God, right? Meaning, the Ramban argues that the Torah has two levels. There's what we read, the Pshat, right? And then there are all these deep secrets that are hidden in the letters themselves, whatever that means. The Gra argues that when Moshe wrote the Torah, the last eight psukim, he only wrote it at that deep level, right? Meaning he mixed up all the letters and they reflected all those truths that they're supposed to reflect. But if the average person would read it, what would he see? A jumble of letters, right? Just a jumble of letters, because he wouldn't be able to pierce the mystical veil, right? And understand what those words meant. Therefore, when Moshe wrote it, was it a complete Torah? in some sense of the word, right? Was it a lie? No, because it didn't say what it says in our Torah. So it was complete, but it didn't say what we said. And Yeshua then comes and rearranges it into humanly understandable speech, right? And obviously, why then are the eight psukim halachically different than the rest of the Torah? Because Yeshua was the one who transformed them. Now, the Gra tries to do a very fancy thing here, which is, if I asked you, is there a machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon in the Gemara, you would say? Yes, obviously. The Gemara said there's a machloket. Right? The Gra said there's no machloket. They're both right. Because Moshe wrote it, but Yeshua wrote it. Right? Moshe wrote it al derech hasod, right? The secrets of the Torah. And Yeshua wrote it al derech Nigla, wrote the revealed level of Torah. So they're both right. That's the Gra's claim. And again, how does it solve the problem? It solves the wrong because it's not a lie. Moshe gave a complete Torah, at least in the mystical sense of that phrase. But it's a different halachic text because Yeshua was the one who transformed it from the metaphysical names of God into the Nigla of the words that we see in front of us. Okay? The last one that I gave for you is the Ramami Panau. So Ramami Panau, he's quoted by the Melo Haroim in the back of the Gemara saying the same as the Gra, but he doesn't seem to actually say that, so let's try to read this quickly. It's the bottom of this page. Right, this is the Asar Marmaros of the Ramami Panau. He writes, Ulam, Kshaloi speak a mechokek an aman la'idol ameitz chur al amo. Right, when Moshe didn't have a chance to defend his nation, its own marito and his sheep, La'achar ma'aseh v'shicharnu v'einenu hifli tushia v'shat ma'aseh v'odia drachah b'shmoneh psukim shabo b'sof atara amru alayhem b'perek komets rabah yachid koretam v'knesset. So skip down, right? First he says Moshe died because he didn't succeed in defending himself to God. So skip down to three lines from the bottom. So now what did he do? Pshutan shel dvarim ki dimua tidameya eino shel Moshe amash yodeh achrei moto kashchet yashchetun. His eyes were like confused about what was going to happen in the future. And then if you skip down, oto dema miguvan migavein hadio min hashachor shebiishon bar ayin yoreid tipin tipin lecholot nozlum mafik keetzem hashamayim. His tears then flowed into the ink. It was both ink and tears, and he seems to think it means both confusion and tears. Right? It's not. And the Rambam thinks it's confusion. He seems to actually think it's tears, but it mixes in to it, into the ink, and in some way that changes it. You can try reading through it and figure out exactly what he means. I'm not 100% sure, because the Malal Roim thinks it's confusion. I think he means it's the ink, but we'll leave that for now. Tomorrow, what I want to focus on is not this Ramami Panau, but is then the next question is, okay, we've now defended, we now understood why you think the Yitzchukim are different, what Dema means, how that defends the halachic claim, and the theological issue, right, and the lying issue, and all of that. Tomorrow, what we're left with is the halachic claim. Okay, what is the upshot of this? This leads to Yachid Koreotam. What does Yachid Koreotam mean? And how does that flow from Moshe Katav Vidyo / Yeshua wrote it? Okay?